the electrostatic attraction is being partially or completely neutralized, and the spark itself does have some mass transfer of electrons in one direction and protons in the other direction. And whether or not the kinetic energy or the momentum, let me think now. I think the momentum of the two is the same, but the kinetic energy is higher on the electrons because there are lighter objects moving faster. So to separate all those effects is going to be interesting. Wesley wanted to make a comment. Go ahead, Wesley.
Yeah, I'm doing the same. Well, a hammer is a force amplifier. Now, in search of free energy, or in quest of free energy, when we investigate Tesla, spark up, we have a gap, and then we have the jump of the energy, but at the same time we have a hammering effect. My understanding is that that spark is nothing more, spark up is nothing more like capacitive coupler. That means capacitive load. It represents capacitance. And capacitor by itself is the storage of energy. So the spark gap reacts sort of like a short time memory. Am I right? That's what I say.
You definitely have a capacitor here. You've got two metallic objects separated by a certain distance with high voltage between the two. Between the two, there's a dielectric. It could be vacuum, it could be air, it could be a sheet of plastic, it could be a block of plastic, and you'll get different amount of capacitor. So you've got a charged capacitor, and you're creating an electrostatic discharge between the two. And you usually hear, depending on the size of the voltage and the size of the capacitor, therefore the amount of instantaneous current of the discharge, you'll hear a snapping sound. It could be a tiny little corona sound if it's a small capacitor, or if it's a great big capacitor with a lot of charge in coulombs, you could hear a very loud crack of a discharge. The sound that you're hearing is very similar to the sound that happens from lightning. You've got a small channel of material that's a plasma at an extremely high temperature, thousands of degrees Fahrenheit or centigrade, during that instant of discharge.
Yeah, but my question is, I'm sorry interrupting you. If hammer is the force amplifier, then spark is a must to be a force amplifier as well.
The loud sound that you hear is an acoustic wave. It's a shock wave in air. That stream of discharged material, that plasma that is the arc, during that instant of the arc is at, let me pick a number, 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The air being instantaneously heated along that channel creates a tremendous amount of air expansion. You hear it as a cracking sound. That is a very strong acoustic wave. So when it comes to measuring all the effects that John is seeing with his laser pen, there's an acoustic sound wave being created by the arc. There is a mass transfer by the electrons and protons moving in the arc itself. And there is the change of the electrostatic attraction that previously is there when there was a charge difference between those two conductors. So there's at least three effects and probably a fourth effect going on there. And to try to separate those all, it's going to be a little bit difficult, but maybe John can handle that. Over to you, John, K2LIW and the TechNet.
Great point you brought up, Dick. I completely forgot about the acoustic wave. Very interesting. I just wanted to modify what Wesley's saying because he's describing a hammer amplifier. The only amplification is the length of the handle. It's just delivering whatever energy you put into it, so I didn't want him to get confused with that. That was my only comment. But thank you for that acoustic wave. I got to remember that.
Let's even cut that.
Yeah, the sound of a lightning bolt is very similar to the sound of a discharge you get from a high voltage generator. I am kind of curious, John, what are you using as a power supply that generates 100 kilovolts? Over to you.
Impulse generator through a sort of like a Tesla coil.
You call it an impulse generator. Is there a rectifier involved? By the way, in the case of a pure Tesla coil, that gives you an AC high voltage, which has certain characteristics. If you're able to make high voltage by DC means, by a Van de Graaff generator or a Windhorst generator, you get some very different effects. What happens at the positive terminal, what happens at the negative terminal with DC high voltage is very different. And those two effects get jumbled together when you're using high voltage AC. Now that I've used high voltage DC, I'm awful glad that I did, because it allowed me to see a lot of effects I wouldn't ordinarily have seen. Over to you, John.
The impulse generated through this coil and into a, it looks like an IBT device. It's a tripler, and that's where I'm getting the voltage from. And of course, the milliamps are nothing, but that's what I'm using.
Are you familiar with a Cockcroft-Walton high voltage circuit? There's various kinds of voltage multipliers that give high voltage DC output. And if you just simply Google the word high voltage experiment and you start looking at the various kinds of high voltage generators, some of them are fairly simple but very effective at making high voltage DC. Do you believe you're getting high voltage DC, real rectification somewhere along the line with your high voltage impulse generator? Back to you, John.
Yes, I'm fairly sure. The high voltage triplets are very similar to the ones that we used in television sets years ago when they wanted to generate that 50,000 up to 80,000 volts could be achieved with those triplets.
Now, in the case of television sets, to my knowledge, even with a color set, they really got very uncomfortable when anything approaching 30 kilovolts occurred. I mean, you've got strong motivation to put high voltage on the anode of a picture tube in order to make a nice bright picture. But as you start approaching 30 kilovolts and beyond, you're starting to make some pretty hard X-rays, and the health hazard capability of that was such that, to my knowledge, essentially no television set had voltage on the picture tube anything beyond 30 kilovolts. Over to you, John.
Comment.
No, absolutely untrue, Dick. If you remember, way back in the dark ages when the solid-state Zenith chassis was first developed, it was a vertical chassis, and it had a modular construction. They used a four-lead capacitor to control the output of the high-voltage assembly. And when that four-lead cap went bad, believe it or not, they went up to 85 to 90,000 volts and actually broke the neck of the CRT, arcing right through the yoke. I don't know if you remember those days.
Okay, so what you're describing is a failure mechanism. Under normal operation, I'd like to believe the set did not exceed 30 kilovolts. What do you think, John?
100% right, 27.5K.
Go ahead, Wesley.
Most of Russian television sets, Eastern European black, they were using 60-65 kilovolts. That's one thing. But the thing is that you didn't answer my question. I mean, my comment. Ham error, by using the small force, is the when you knock with the hammer, is the force amplifier. And it's not only by me, but this is also by Wikipedia. So, is it the statement that the spark gap, because of Hammer effect, is the signal amplifier or force amplifier? Is it true or false?
Okay, let me go step by step and see if I understand what you're saying. If I took a 1 pound hammer and I apply a force to it of 1 pound while I arc it in my hand across 2 feet, and then I hit a nail. I've only applied 1 pound of force to a 1 pound hammer, and I did it through a 2 foot length, and I could figure out the number of joules of stored energy that I've created in the process of me moving that hammer. At the instant the hammer hits the nail, the force on the nail could easily be 500 pounds, and the nail in turn will penetrate the wood a certain distance. And if I calculate the distance that the wood has been penetrated by the nail, and the force that was required to do it, and the total energy that I've imparted to the nail, versus the energy that I've imparted to the hammer when I swung it. There is no gain in energy. There's a definite force multiplication. That impact of the hammer on the nail has created a impulse of energy, which is a very high force for a very short period of time. And so the total energy I've imparted to the nail is slightly less than what my muscle gave to the hammer. But it's a beautiful force multiplier. Is that sort of what you're saying, Wesley? Go ahead.
Yeah, to the sense you are right. There is a small variation if understanding that, but it's not enough time for you to discuss that. My question is, we have a force amplifier, and that's definitely hammer, it is a force amplifier. Then the spark must be, spark up must be, by the definition, the force amplifier, right, Rook?
You're saying the spark itself is a force multiplier.
No, the spark gap with the spark in it must be, in comparison to hammer, the force amplifier, the same way as the hammer is.
Electronically speaking, I might agree with you. If I'm charging a oil-filled capacitor, and I am applying 50 milliamperes of current, and if I do it for a long enough period of time, the capacitor comes up to 1,000 volts. And then I put a screwdriver across the two terminals of that capacitor. Even though I only applied 50 milliamperes for a certain length of time, the screwdriver across those two terminals is going to discharge that capacitor in a millisecond, and 5,000 amperes might flow during that millisecond. Electronically speaking, the discharge of that capacitor is a huge force multiplier, very similar to the hammer hitting the nail. I took many seconds at 50 milliamperes to charge the capacitor, and 1/2 CV², I put a certain amount of energy and a certain number of joules of charge, certain amount of joules of energy and a certain number of coulombs of charge I put into that capacitor. And because the capacitor has got a very small internal equivalent series resistance, when I discharge it instantaneously, I can get a huge amount of current output for a very brief period of time. So electronically speaking, it is a kind of a ampere force multiplier. I could, in theory, take that many thousands of amperes that flows and put it into some kind of a solenoid, and very briefly I could get a lot of force out of that. But I'm not getting any gain of energy. The energy that I put into the capacitor and the energy that I get back out will be close but slightly smaller, I believe. Over to you, Wesley.
Here's a few things that I would like to touch. When you have an engine of the car, the small strokes, but at a certain frequency, adding to the overall the power and the speed, the faster the car goes, the less the energy you need to sustain that. It's adding to that. So it's not that you knock once, but you're actually constantly adding. And when the object, it goes into the motion, there is less energy needed to sustain the motion. Let me drop. But by that token, we're talking about the spark gap, that is a capacitor, so it's a memory, it's a short-term memory, is the storage of energy. Then we're talking about factor of amplification of the energy with the spark jump, and then we're talking about the frequency of the spark. That is, in comparison to the engine of the car, the same kind of mechanism. So now I'm trying to understand the free energy device, which is not really the free energy device, but we may say we utilize the energy that is unknown or known, but actually we, using the certain mechanism of efficiency, now we have a situation in which, let me drop, now we have a situation in which the frequency of the spark adds, and we have a scenario that we have discussed, that we have a vertically capacitor, and then we have a current going through the capacitor, I mean, variable one, let's say, both. And on the right-hand side, we have a coil connected to that in parallel. The magnetic flux will go to the right, affecting the electromagnetic field in the coil. This coil will actually try to recharge at the end of the cycle this capacitor. And now we have the explanation of all everything that I said, the Vladimir Yudkin phenomenon of ringing pattern in reverse. Did you get it? Back to you.
I might not have gotten it, but let me go one step at a time. The energy in joules or watt seconds that I put into the capacitor when I charge it, and I've done that for some significant number of seconds at 50 milliamperes in my particular example, I eventually bring the capacitor up to, say, 1,000 volts. It took me many seconds to do that. When I put the screwdriver across the two terminals and I present a resistance of a few milliohms, the capacitor has an extremely small internal equivalent series resistance of only milliohms, and I get thousands of amperes to flow for a very brief period of time. And if I took a careful measurement of the energy I get out of the discharge versus the energy that I put in during the charging of the capacitor, I'm reasonably sure I would get a little bit less energy out than I put in. I'm not getting a gain. Now let me go back to an automobile. If I take an automobile at rest and I accelerate the car between 0 and 10 miles an hour, I put a certain amount of energy into that car, kinetic energy. I've done a certain amount of work to do that. Work for a period of time, and it's a total amount of energy. I've raised the speed 10 miles an hour. If the car was already moving at 90 miles an hour, and I raise the speed to 100, again, I've made 10 miles an hour of increase in velocity of the car. In that second experiment, a tremendous more energy is required.
How about if you sustain the motion?
To sustain the motion at 100, where I'm overcoming a lot of wind resistance, would take a lot more continuous energy to keep it there than if I'm moving it at 10 miles an hour.
You remove the air resistance, or you don't speed 100 miles an hour, but you speed, let's say, 50 miles an hour. You just want to sustain. Then the number of energy needed is less with the increase of energy, if you disregard the fact of air.
Okay, assume there was no air resistance, and I start up with the car at 0 and I move it to 10 miles an hour, and I carefully measure the energy input to do that. Then I start off with the car at 40 miles an hour and I accelerate it to 50 with no wind resistance. In both cases, I've increased the speed by 10 miles an hour. However, I know the mass of the car, I know the speed it's moving, I know that energy of kinetic energy is 1/2 mv squared. If I compare mv squared of 50 miles an hour versus mv squared of 40 miles an hour, I'll get a very big number. When I compare the mv squared of 10 miles an hour versus 0 miles an hour, that difference is a much, much smaller number. The bottom line is that kinetic energy, when you're already moving, to increase the same number of miles an hour, it takes a lot more energy to do it. In reality, if I want to do it in the same length of time, I better have a lot more horsepower in that engine, even if there is no wind resistance. That's what I believe happens. Back to you, Wesley.
By talking about the car engine, I was trying to point that the faster the car goes, the less energy you need to sustain the motion. The same story is with many devices. The gas heater, whatever, we're not going to go to that. But what I was trying to do is, when we have a spark and a spark gap, at which we accumulate the energy, we're not talking about over unit as well, yet. We accumulate the energy, then we have a reservoir of the energy, then we create a spark, then the spark has the mechanical factor of the energy as well as the electrical one, that means impact, but definitely is the impulse amplifier. Now, when that impulse amplifier amplifies the impulse, and we have the capacitive coupling between the two coils, or we have, let's say, capacitor. Let's say we have a capacitor, and we connect the coil in parallel to that capacitor. What's going to happen is, at the end of the cycle, this capacitor, because of the magnetic field to the right, with the vector to the right, will try to charge create the electromagnetic field into the coil. Now what's happening is the coil is going to charge back or try to charge back the capacitor, but the next impulse is coming. And now we are having the reverse ringing pattern that's supposed to go to infinity with the amplitude raising. It does not. It dies with the spark. So the faster the spark, the less are the losses. So if we do not
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
But we talk about it only like very efficient amplification or very efficient energy transfer. That does make a sense, doesn't it? Back to you.
I'm going to go back to the very first step of your very last transmission, Wesley. And I realize that over the last few weeks, or maybe a month or two, you have made a particular statement multiple times. You have said that when a car is moving faster, it takes less energy to maintain that speed than it's moving slower. In other words, if I had a car moving at 10 miles an hour, it takes a certain amount of energy to keep it moving 10 miles an hour. If the car is moving 50 miles an hour, you say it takes less energy to maintain 50 miles an hour. Once you subtract wind resistance, you say it takes...
Sustain, not maintain. Sustain. The losses are less, the amount of energy to just compensate the losses is less. Back to you.
Okay, you're saying it takes less energy to sustain the car at 50 miles an hour than it is to sustain the car at 10 miles an hour.
That's correct. You're burning less fuel when you have the car at 60 miles an hour.
Okay, you have said that many times over the last couple of months. How do you know that is true?
5 years. To start the car, after a while you need 2 gears. After a while you need 1 finger or 1 gear to sustain the motion. True or false?
In the case of rubber tires on an automobile that had been sitting in a parking lot for a while, and the flat bottom of the rubber tire takes on a certain shape, and the cords of the tire take on a certain set pattern, to begin rolling the car at first means that as far as the tires are concerned and their deformation, because they've been sitting there for the last day or two, you are doing an uphill roll even though you think you're on level ground. Without a doubt, when you first start pushing a car with rubber tires that are pneumatic tires, it takes a lot of energy at first because of the effect of the tires. If I had steel wheels on that car with good bearings on railroad rails, I wouldn't see that effect.
I am convinced that the total frictional forces, if I take away wind resistance, the total frictional forces of keeping a railroad car moving at 50 miles an hour is considerably greater than the frictional forces required to be overcome to sustain a railroad car at 10 miles an hour. I really believe that. I know you're saying the opposite, and your automobile example could be contaminated by the set shape that happens with rubber tires with the cords in an ordinary automobile tire. Over to you, Wesley.
Thanks, Jim. Okay. Well, I'm 54 years old. When I was young, when I was older, when I was in here, I happened to push many, many, many objects, including the wagons of the railroad tracks, whatever. Anyhow, the effect was always the same. 3-5 guys to push something, whether it was on the steel wheels or was on the tires. Then, my car is 2.5-ton car, maybe more. On the very flat road, horizontal, I am able to push this car after somebody helps me to get it started. I don't believe and I don't agree with that, that the amount of energy that you need to start equals the amount of energy that you need to sustain the motion. It's simply not true. Enter exam.
And your experience is telling you that, and I accept your experience, but there's another explanation. Back in the days when I had rayon tires, rayon corded tires, and they would take a set overnight, the first couple of miles of driving of that automobile, I would hear thumping of those tires because of the flat spots that occurred the night before. So tires do take a set. In the case of the railroad cars that you've pushed, when a railroad car has been sitting for 24 hours in one spot, those roller bearings in the bearings of the wheels have settled down to metal-to-metal contact, and they push the grease out of the way. When you start rolling that railroad car, and the grease on those tapered bearings in each one of those wheels, the grease gets spread and gets an even spacing around the perimeter of the wheel race. Now you've got a thoroughly lubricated bearing once you start rolling that railroad car. So the way the grease behaves in the bearings could account for the fact that it takes less force to maintain, to sustain the speed of the car once it has been rolling, but you get the sticky effect at first because you've got a dried bearing underneath that individual ball bearing or individual tapered bearing of those individual railroad reels.
I'll give you another example. Sorry, interrupting you. I have, in my houses, I have the Luna 310 Fi. You can Google for it. It's a piece of German engineering coming from Second World War II. It was sold to Canadian. It's called over there. It's a very small device hanging on the wall. It doesn't take a space, and it's tremendously heating. And it does work this way. You first deliver the gas, and the flame starts only for 3 seconds. But the gas is like directed on one tube only, and it's heating in one spot. After 3 seconds, the flame diminishes and modulates itself by electronic device to sustain the motion, to keep the temperature. That means, at first 3 seconds, it's heating to an enormously high, and then it is going down, and it's only keeping the amount of energy needed to sustain the temperature, and the water is flowing. This is the same mechanism. Back to you, Dick.
I haven't seen that device, and I guess I'll have to find a website on that.
Luna 310 FI. I have it for years. They have much better devices right now. It works the same way. Exactly. It is made by, well, you just could put L-U-N-A 310 FI. And you're gonna see the description. N2XG.
Okay, L-U-N-A 310 FI. I'll look that up. And so you feel that once you start heating something, it becomes easier once it gets flowing. And once you start moving a railroad car, it gets easier once it gets moving. And that it takes less energy to sustain the velocity once it's moving, as opposed to the energy required in the beginning. I know you believe that.
No, I see it by the money that I have paid in one house before I converted it to Luna 210 FI. Then I can compare this, the neighbors being jealous about the fact that I'm paying one quarter of the amount of money that they are paying, and the Canadians simply were smart because they have purchased the Junkers. Junkers was the German heater only for the water, then converted to everything, water and heating, that was actually in Europe for 20 years. And the Canadian gave this device to be manufactured by Italian, because they do sexy devices. They really do pretty looking devices. Device is extremely small. It's hanging on a wall. Let's say 10 times smaller, maybe 20 times smaller than typical heating stove. And there is no need for the tank, nothing. All you have is one small device hanging on a wall, 4,000 square feet of the house, heated, no problem. The energy use, they say that is 38 to 45%. Well, I experienced 67. Back to you.
So Lunar is quite a bit better than Junkers. How do you spell Junkers?
Junkers, no. Junkers was the grandfather of Luna 3210 FI. I have it in my house. Now I'm converting another house to that as well. Each tenant has it. I don't have to pay for hidden hardware at all. And they pay really a small amount of money. Junkers was Y-U-K-N-E-R-S. That was, or maybe the first word, character was U, but no, Y, Junkers. I don't know. But that was definitely German technology. You're going to find all of the history about it.
Okay, I'll take a look at that. I'm going to have to leave you guys. I'm way beyond the time. I've got to go to work tomorrow. And this was TechNet number 1316 of the series that began in September of 1982. Mel, if you're still there, you might want to say some closing words. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, about to finish for tonight. Getting late. Got some things to do tomorrow. Very interesting as always. And so I think I will say good night, and we'll try to do it again next week. Take care, everybody. Have a great week. This is K2KEY 73.
Dick, I'm sorry. I need to make a first purchase. I don't want to spend the money unnecessarily. Just a few sentences, if you can.
Go ahead. I might not be able to advise you as to what to buy and what not to buy, but go ahead.
General radio type 1633A incremental inductance bridge. The device was invented for the purpose of, it states, the effective inductance of the coil or transformer winding can change depending on DC and AC current that is current. This change is the value, and it is known as incremental inductance. Conventional AC bridges, which use fairly low levels of AC excitation, cannot measure this change. An instrument that must measure that inductor. We are very subjecting the inductor to DC and AC current similar to those under which the inductor will operate. And that's why they invented the device. I just want to make sure that this device is useful, and I do not understand why, with the real environment, the inductor change.
Okay. I cannot definitely tell you that this is a good purchase, but I will tell you that the General Radio Company, 20 or so years ago, did make some rather well-respected, rather good pieces of test equipment. I can tell you that. So, to my knowledge, General Radio made very few bad pieces of test equipment, just like Hewlett-Packard has made very, very few bad ones. But Hewlett-Packard did make at least one bad one that I know of. Now, every inductor that's used in a power supply has a certain amount of inductance when no steady-state current is flowing through the inductor. But if the inductor is a smoothing choke, part of a power supply, every inductor will decrease in inductance as more current flows through the inductor. Every inductor does that. It's called partial saturation of the magnetic core. You want no saturation at all of the magnetic core if you want full inductance. As you pour more and more current through every inductor that has a magnetic core, the inductance will slightly decrease. And if I understand correctly, this incremental inductance bridge will subject your unknown inductor to a steady state DC current at the same time it measures inductance. So for power supply inductors, that could be a valuable measurement. Back to you, Wesley.
Yes, again, I don't know for sure if it allows me to connect my inductors, but I believe what it does is I can put this instead of the inductor that I have in the circuit. I can put this inductor in incremental inductance into that circuit, and this will work as if employed to the heavy environment, and it will give me the accurate, exact inductance value under the load. That's what I believe it is.
I think you're asking, will this General Radio instrument act as a inductor substitute? That I don't know. But by the words you've given me, it sounds like it measures the inductance under working conditions with current flowing through it. That's what I think incremental inductance bridge is doing. But that's a guess. I have never used that instrument. I can't be sure. Going to have to leave you. Bye-bye for now. Be kind to each other, you guys. K2RAW clear.
Thank you very much, Dick. I'm sorry for keeping you so long.
Thank you, Dick. Have a great evening. You too, Mel.
Well, thank you very much for your assistance.
Thanks, Dick. We'll listen to you next week. Have a good day. Bye.
Have a good night, Eric.
Good night, Wesley. Have a great evening.
And you put a smile on my face.
That's good. Keep left. Talk to you tomorrow. KC2WGB clear.
By the way, the question well done. I couldn't do it better. yeah. Dig is really, really smart guy.
That's why we listen to him. Sometimes he can save us a lot of work, and he always gives me a new direction to look into. I like that. And very important with what we're trying to do.
Today, TechNet was for me a full-time adrenaline.
You know, information is like a bottomless pit. There's so much of it, you know, you just reach in there and pull it out, but trying to filter out what you need and what you don't need, that's the tough part.
Oh, yeah. John, talking about my wife, I found online Tesla coil design, 460, 70, whatever pages. And it was in... it was $21, whatever, $22, but shipping and waiting for it. And Anya told me, listen, can't you just print it out? I said, yes, I can.
The time is 12:46 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2VL repeater.
They disconnect the
clock. Nine. Set.
The following is a QST. The United States will support a new ham band near 500 kilohertz at WARC 2012. The World Radio Sport Team Championship is coming back to U.S. soil in 2014. The FCC ramps up enforcement in ham radio, and a Minnesota ham club is awarded a grant from Pepsi-Cola to buy new radio gear. Find out who on Amateur Radio Newsline, report number 1728, coming your way right now. From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's first independent, on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now, reporting from Reno, Nevada, here is Don Carlson, KQ6 FM. A new ham medium frequency allocation could be in ham radio's future. Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, is in the newsroom with more.
The ARRO reports that the United States is supporting a new secondary amateur radio allocation at 461 to 469 kilohertz, and again from 471 to 478 kilohertz. This after both the Federal Communications Commission and the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, also known as the NTIA, both spectrum regulators have agreed to support this secondary allocation at the 2012 World Radio Communications Conference slated for Geneva, Switzerland. The FCC and NTIA formally presented the proposal at a meeting of the Second Permanent Consultative Committee of the Inter-American Telecommunications Commission held a few weeks ago in Brazil. However, the proposal will likely draw opposition from maritime interests both domestically and internationally. They have expressed opposition to any amateur radio allocation in the 415 to 526.5 kilohertz spectrum. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, in Los Angeles, the City of Angels.
The full story is online at tinyurl.com/2A4ZWRY, which is a direct link to the ARRL web news item. As previously reported in the 2010 Global Amateur Radio Emergency Communications Conference, or GEREC 2010, is scheduled for October 11th to the 12th on the Caribbean island of Curacao. It's now been announced that one of the highlights of this year's conference will be an actual emergency communications exercise. This is a way of exploring how information sharing across borders can be improved. The Global Amateur Radio Emergency Communications Conference, supported by the International Radio Union, all three IARU regions, and the ARRL. With its theme of learning through practicing, this year's conference is an important opportunity to emergency communicators to discuss recent events, discover technical solutions to problems, and how to cooperate with professional partners. The Teen World Radio Sport Championship Games will be held in the United States, and two former participants will be heading up the event. Bruce Tennant is here with the details.
Hosting rights for the 2014 World Radio Sport Team Championship, or WRTC, have been awarded to the New England WRTC 2014 Organizing Committee. This organization is a newly formed independent group, not part of any existing organization, national society, or club. Heading up the group are former WRTC participants Doug Grant, K1DG, as chairman, and Randy Thompson, K5ZD, as co-chairman. They're joined by a committee made up of some of the world's greatest contesters and DXers, including CQ Magazine's John Doerr, K1AR, Kids Day creator Larry Tree Tyree, M6TR, ARRL New England director Tom Frenary, K1KI, to mention only three. According to Doug Grant, K1DG, writing on the group's news blog, since the first radio sport team championship in Seattle, Washington back in 1990, there have been six WRTC events with a total of 234 teams and 468 operator spots. Grant adds that those 468 operator positions have been occupied by 353 different operators from 49 different DXCC entities. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Bruce Tennant, K6PZW in Los Angeles.
More about planning and how to qualify a team for the competition is online at www.wrtc2014.org. Radio World Online says that the long-anticipated and first-ever national EAS test will not likely be scheduled in early 2011. A federal source confirmed to the magazine that the reason for the delay is to allow time for additional outreach and education with the public, with broadcasters, with state and local emergency management, and federal partners. The online magazine says that the extra outreach will enable the alert and warning community to be better prepared for the nationwide exercise when it finally does take place. British Petroleum has pulled an ad for a subsidiary ARCO that used what sounded like emergency activation or EAS tones. This after members of the Society of Broadcast Engineers EAS Committee and participants in SBE's EAS Exchange identified a radio commercial as the source of unexpected triggering of EAS alert receivers. The commercial started with effects that sounded like a shortened EAS header tone, followed by the spoken phrase, "The following alert is from ARCO." The EAS-like headers were partial, but contained enough information to mimic the start of a real EAS header, because it used the proper frequencies and data rates. When this commercial was played by a station that is being monitored as a local EAS source, it may cause some decoder equipment to unmute and print a partial message. For those not aware of how EAS messages work, while the internal monitor speaker is unmuted, the alert is not relayed by the EAS unit on the monitoring station. Although the problem would only affect stations that airs the ARCO commercial material and have a particular type of EAS equipment, the SBE has recommended that stations check the affected commercial material. It should be noted that the existence of EAS header data in this commercial might be considered an FCC violation when aired. Regulation 11.45 says that no person may transmit or cause to transmit the EAS codes or attention signal or recording or simulation thereof in any circumstance other than an actual national, state, or local area emergency or authorized test of the EAS system. Though the spot did not use actual EAS tones, ad agency Ogilvy and Mather Worldwide, which created the commercial, stated it regretted the confusion the spot may have caused. For those who've not heard it, an MP3 of the commercial can be downloaded at tinyurl.com/ArcoSpot. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline, heard on bulletin stations around the world, including the KL7 ION repeater, serving America's last true frontier from Anchorage, Alaska. The FCC has sent a warning notice to an Ohio ham alleging him of being the source of interference to a 75-meter net. Amateur Radio Newsline's Norm Seeley, KI7UP, has the details.
A warning notice dated September 3rd was sent to Charles A. Hathaway, W8ROX, by FCC Special Counsel Laura Smith. In it, Smith says that the commission received several complaints of interference to the Century Club net operating on 3902 kilohertz. At her request, the staff at the commission's monitoring station began investigating in order to determine the location of this interference. Over the next month, the monitoring station confirmed that the interference was taking place and used its directional finding equipment to determine that the signal was coming from a location north of Athens, Ohio. The commission's Detroit field office was notified, and they began a field investigation into the matter. On July 21st, at approximately 10:20 p.m., the field agents heard an audible transmission interrupt the ongoing Century Club net. They began using their vehicle's directional finding equipment to determine the location of the offending transmitter. At 12:40 a.m., they had a positive directional find to a beam antenna. At that time, they knocked on the door and attempted to inspect the station. No one answered the door. They returned the next day at 4:21 p.m., and at that time, they were able to inspect the station. During the inspection, Hathaway indicated to the agents that he was unaware that his station had been transmitting during the time in question. This was because he had been having problems with his push-to-talk button getting turned on accidentally. As part of the inspection, the agents took pictures of Hathaway's equipment, including a close-up of his push-to-talk button and its relative position to his microphone and the rest of his equipment. In her letter, Smith told Hathaway that his argument that he was unaware that his station had been transmitting during the time in question because of this problem with his push-to-talk button was unpersuasive. She wrote that one of the commission's field agents specifically noted in his report that the push-to-talk button is not located on or near the rest of Hathaway's equipment. Rather, that it was strung through the handle of his desk drawer and away from the desktop where the remainder of his equipment is located. Moreover, according to the agents, the push-to-talk button appeared to be in working order during the inspection. Smith concluded by telling Hathaway that his alleged operation as described in the warning letter and verified by the commission's field staff is contrary to the basis and purpose of the amateur radio service. This as it is set out in section 97.1 of the commission's rules. Also, that it is a violation of section 97.101D of the rules. She then warned Hathaway that the commission expects him to abide by its rules. As such, her letter to him serves notice that if operations of this type reoccurs, Hathaway could be subject to severe penalties. These include anything from a modification proceeding to restrict the frequencies upon which he may operate to a fine or even revocation of his license. For Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Arm Seeley, KI7UP, following the FCC enforcement action from Scottsdale, Arizona.
A link to the FCC warning letter can be found at the URL found in this week's printed Amateur Radio Newsline report. A follow-up to our story several months ago about Christopher M. Myers, whom the FCC claimed they found to be operating an unlicensed broadcast station on 95.9 megahertz of Lauderdale, Florida. On September 9th, the regulatory agency affirmed a $10,000 fine issued to Myers as a notice of apparent liability for monetary forfeiture on July 12th. Amateur Radio Newsline's Fred Vobey, W8HDU, has more.
By the way of background, back on August the 14th of 2009, the Enforcement Bureau's Miami office issued a notice of unlicensed operation to Myers for operating an FM broadcast station from his residence on 91.7 megahertz without a license. The notice warned him that continued operation could subject him to further enforcement action. On July the 21st of 2009, in response to a complaint that Myers was still operating an unlicensed station at his residence in Lauderdale, Florida, agents from the Miami office used direction finding equipment to locate the source of the broadcast transmission on a frequency of 95.9 megahertz. It was traced to the same building from which Myers previously operated the unlicensed radio station at 91.7 megahertz. In the ensuing month, the Federal Communications Commission said it received continual complaints regarding its operation. On March the 7th of 2010, the agents from the Miami office inspected the unlicensed station, which was located in a condominium owned by Myers. The agents observed a coaxial cable that connected a roof-mounted antenna on the condominium building to an FM radio transmitter operating on a frequency of 95.9 megahertz located inside Myers condominium unit. The agents also observed that Christopher Myers was the only person present inside his unit at the time of the commission's inspection. This past July 12th, the Enforcement Bureau's Miami office issued a notice of apparent liability forfeiture in the amount of $10,000 to Myers. In the time since then, Myers has not filed a response to the NAL. Now, based on the information before the Federal Communications Commission, it has affirmed the forfeiture and given Myers the customary 30 days to pay the fine or file an appeal. I'm Fred Vobey, W8HDU.
At airtime, it's unknown if Myers has contacted the FCC regarding this matter or if he has paid the fine. For the second time in 2 years, copper thieves have struck the Butte Broadcasting Company's KKXXAM transmitter site in Paradise, California. According to the Oroville Mercury Register, this time the thieves made off with about 22,000 feet of number 10 wire from the ground system, which was apparently bundled into lengths of 10 to 20 feet and then carted away. Station manager Andrew Palmquist said the transmitter was able to remain on the air. Palmquist told the paper that the thieves apparently knew what they were doing. They just left enough wire for the ground system to allow the station to continue to broadcast. Palmquist told the paper that the thieves took a back road to the tower, avoiding a locked gate. After the first wire theft in 2008, Palmquist said copper grounding wires were replaced and a concrete footing was poured about every 10 to 15 feet along the length of the wire in hopes of discouraging future thefts. However, this time, the thieves cut and removed the wires between the concrete. According to a scrap copper website, with the world's economy still not very stable, that kind of wire is only fetching between $1.22 and $2.75 a pound. So the thieves went to a lot of work and risked their lives to get very little in return. KKXX management is asking anyone with knowledge about the copper theft to contact the station. The General Electric Company is closing its last incandescent light bulb factory in the United States. This to comply with Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007. According to news reports, the resulting savings in energy and greenhouse gas emissions are expected to be immense. But the move also had unintended consequences. Rather than setting off long-predicted surge in the domestic manufacturer replacement lights, such as compact fluorescent, many are already being manufactured overseas. Most come from China and are assembled at a low cost that domestic manufacturers cannot match. Some names in the news. First up is Richard G. Summers, W6NSV of Pacific Palisades, California, who has been named to receive the Radio Club of America's Special Recognition Award. This for his commitment in initiating and implementing the Radio Club of America's Youth Education Program. Summers and other recipients of Radio Club of America's sponsored awards will receive their honors, and he will receive the award at the organization's 101st Annual Awards Banquet to be held this November in New York City. The 2010 AMSAT North American Board of Directors election has been completed, with Tom Clark, K3IO, Lou McFadden, W5DID, and Gould Smith, WA4SXM, elected as regular members, and Tony Montero, AA2TX, as the board's alternate member. A total of 813 ballots were returned and counted. In accordance with the bylaws of AMSAT North America, those receiving the three highest numbers of votes are elected as regular members of the board of directors for the next 2 years, with the fourth becoming an alternate to serve 1 year until the next election. This is Ham Radio News for today's Radio Amateur. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline, with links to the world from our only official website at www.arnewsline.org, and being relayed by the volunteer services of the following Radio Amateur. Radio Amateurs of Canada has announced that Chris Weissner, VA3SM, has assumed the position of office coordinator, and Dave Parks, VE3AV, is continuing his role as membership administrator. Chris is full-time, while Dave is part-time. Office hours are Monday to Friday, 10 to 1600 Eastern Time, and the telephone number is 613-244-4367, or toll-free, 877-273-8304. With these changes, Radio Amateurs of Canada says that it's looking forward to offering improved service to Canadian amateurs in general, and our members in particular. In Ham Radio News from Space, word that the crew on board the International Space Station activated the slow scan television experiment on September 14th. G8ATE in Leicester, England, reports having received four good images from the ISS during the 12:32 and 14:06 UTC passes before the crew switched back to packet operation. Arisat Project Manager Gould Smith, WA4SXM, says that the Arisat-1 satellite is completed and is currently undergoing vibration testing in Orlando, Florida. Smith notes that the shipping container for both the flight unit and the backup is under construction, which will lead to the shipping of the two flight-ready satellites to Houston in the very near future. From Houston, NASA will be sending the satellites on to Russia at the end of the month. Once there, the CURS experiment will be attached, additional testing done, and then the entire flight package will be transported to the Baikonur Cosmodrome for launch. Arisat-1, which is the former SuitSat-2, is scheduled to be transported to the International Space Station in January 2011. It will be manually released into orbit during a spacewalk sometime next February. Amateur radio operators in the Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. area may be interested in becoming a team member of the Small High Altitude Expandable Balloon Launch. Pat Kilroy, N8PK, is assembling his team and says he needs hams who are willing to establish one or more effective ground stations. N8PK held an initial planning session at the Carroll County Amateur Radio Club meeting in Westminster, Maryland on September